Thank you all for being here today. I want to acknowledge my co-author, Augustino Bohr, also at Kansas State University. So I'll be talking about cover and forage crops in the Central Great Plains region. If you look at some recent published research, you know, at this meeting a few years ago, we were hearing that cover crops didn't use water, or some people were speculating they didn't use water. Well, we've now have, you know, there's several publications out there that show that, you know, cover crops do use water, and we can reduce subsequent crop yield following that. And there's also some papers that have shown that cover crop mixtures can use water similar to single crop, single species mixtures. Some of the work we did, we published after 5 years of growing cover crop, and we did see some improvement in the soil health, but unfortunately those benefits were short-lived. But as Darren said, you know, we maybe need to look at that at a 10-year or longer horizon before we can see those changes persist, be more resilient. We've also shown those cover crops that produce more biomass can aid in weed suppression, and that's very important when we start looking at some of these weeds, the kochia and Palmer amaranth, that are now resistant to many of our different herbicides. And then recently we published some work looking at the growing either a cover or forage crop, and economically there is some potential for growing a forage crop, but not so much a cover crop, and I'll share some of that data today. So if we look at that, the region, wheat fallow is a common practice, either in a two-year rotation of wheat fallow, where we have a rather long fallow period of about 15 months, or a three-year rotation of a wheat summer crop fallow. In our area, we either grow dryland corn or grain sorghum, and so we have two shorter fallow periods of about 11 months. So we have been looking at both of these systems over time, and integrating cover crop or forages into that fallow, those fallow periods. Something that this terminology between cover crops and forages, we've kind of really blurred the distinction. You know, prior, and that when we talked about a cover crop or green manures, you know, this was not a crop that we were harvesting. But now we're talking about haying or grazing our cover crops. And another term I've heard of just recently is cash cover crops. So, and so maybe it's semantics, but I think it's a little bit of a slippery slope. So does that mean every forage out there is a cover crop? Yeah, you know, I don't know. Or how do we define good forage management from a cover crop? And funding, okay. Yeah. Funding not only for us, but also funding for the producer. And I'll show some of that. But you're right. At the end of the day, a lot of this boils down to dollars and cents. At the end of the day, it all has to make sense. But our work, we've looked at the true cover crop, and we've also looked at the forage crop angle. So Kansas here, Manhattan in the eastern part of the state. I'm located in the southwest in Garden City. Let's see here. Pointer. So I'm located here in the southwest. Augustine is up here at our Hayes unit. Let me talk on three different experiments. Experiment one and two was done down here in Garden City starting back in 2007. We work with about 19 inches of annual precipitation, but we also have a lot higher ET demand than Montana does. And then at the HB unit, we have the ability to integrate cattle there at that location, and they work with about 21 inches of annual precip. So in the first experiment, Garden City, we started that work in 07. It was a no-till wheat fallow study, randomized complete block split plot, where each crop phase is present every year. Replicated four times, total of 27 treatments. We had looked at both cover and forage, and then we looked at both fall and spring planting of cover crops in that study. So this experiment, even though it's small plot, is over about 35 acres in plots. So it's a very large study. In 2012, we changed that and went to a wheat, grain, sorghum, fallow. So we started looking at a three-year rotation and looking at putting the only a spring cover then in that fallow period. So again, Round West Complete Block, 15 treatments. So in 2017, that would be 10 years of continuous having cover crops in the rotation for that period. So getting to be a rather long-term experiment. So we managed both. This is how we did it. We split these plots. The winter cover crops were terminated when triticale initiated heading, which for the winters was about May 15th, and the springs was about spring triticale would have been about the 1st of June. Then we would plant winter wheat about the 1st of October. So this shows a picture of one half of the plot being just sprayed out as the true cover, and then this picture was taken right before we swathed and baled off the winter peas. And then this is coming back at right before planting wheat, where we've hayed off the half this plot and the other half is left standing. We have done a lot of work looking at available soil water in the profile, and what we see is in wet years, this is cover crop biomass and this is available soil water in inches in a 6-foot profile measured gravimetrically. We don't really see a response in available soil water when years we get favorable moisture. But in our dry years, we see this pretty significant reduction in available soil water when we grow the cover crop. So really, it really depends on this environmental, year-to-year environmental effect. We do see an increase in precipitation storage efficiency where we grow more biomass. But our increase in precipitation capture is not enough to make up for the amount of water that cover crop or forage crop used in growing it. And simply, water makes grain. So this is some of our data looking at available soil water, planting plus growing season precipitation and winter wheat yield. Get a nice response here of about 4.7 bushel per acre inch. And then if you look at Nielsen's work there at Akron, very, very similar response. So about every inch of less soil water that you have available from growing something, that you reduce your wheat yield by a bushel. Then looking at wheat yield over, this is just a couple of examples. We have many, many years of this type of data. But here's 2010, a favorable year. Fallow is over here at about 70 bushel per acre, so a very good wheat yield situation, and really growing a cover crop or forage crop in place of fallow did not hurt our wheat yield, and we've not seen a difference in wheat yield response whether we grow a hay crop or a cover crop. We do see a slight difference in available soil water, in that the cover we have a little bit more soil water available, but that's not shown up in the wheat yields. Continuous winter wheat, more intensive rotation. Here we do have a little bit lower yield. You take a look at a year like 2012. Here we only have 30 bushel wheat yield and growing something in place of fallow. Here we're looking at up to about a 70% reduction in wheat yield in that kind of case. So across all of these years, we can kind of estimate when we might see a reduction in wheat yield and when we won't. And it's somewhere around that 50 bushel per acre mark. If you have the potential of growing 50 bushel wheat yield or more in a following fallow, we don't tend to see much impact of growing something in place of fallow. But if you're under that 50 bushel type of yield potential, then we have pretty consistently seen a reduction in wheat yield. Of course, you have year-to-year variability depending on when rainfall comes from during the growing season, but that's a pretty good indicator of where we might see a positive or negative response. Well, we've not seen a positive response, but where we would see a negative response. So that led us to this idea of flex fallow. So if we could predict what the rain is going to do, we could all be very good farmers and researchers. But so what we do at the time of planting a cover crop or not, we simply use this Paul Brown probe, and because it's what producers could easily go out and use. And if we have at least 14 inches of available soil moisture, and if we look at the Climate Prediction Center, and if they're calling for kind of neutral or favorable conditions, then we'll go ahead and plant a cover crop. And if these two conditions are not met, then we leave it fallow before planting wheat. Unfortunately, if we all know that, the Climate Prediction Center is not very accurate, and they give themselves a grade, and they don't give themselves they're grading themselves, and they give themselves a very poor grade. So that tells you, you know, the accuracy of that. So that's the downfall of that. But hopefully, we're hoping over time we can maybe take advantage of those good years. Looking at grain sorghum yield, so this is 2 years after growing the wheat crop. So far, we only saw a negative response on grain sorghum only in 1 year of out of 3 years. And where we had about 110 bushel grain sorghum following fallow, and then up to about a 20 bushel reduction in, depending on the cover crop grown in that fallow period. Now, we did not see any difference in plant available water at the time of planting the grain sorghum crop, but this correlates nicely to our wheat yield. And so one of the good things, growing wheat, one of the most important benefits of growing wheat in our area is the amount of residue that wheat crop grows. So I think what we're seeing here is just a difference of in-season precipitation use efficiency, where we have a lot more wheat stubble. Even though we're talking 6 bushel, we have 0 bushel where that oat was. So that difference in wheat residue showed up in the subsequent grain sorghum crop. So we looked at economic net returns, and I did have an economist sign off on this. So, but if we put all the input, the variable costs and inputs and expenses here, you know, the chart would be off of the all the way to the ceiling. So what this shows is looking at the economic returns of growing a cover crop or forage crop, or the other, which would be a fallow system. We looked at a spring pea grain, and then we also looked at continuous winter wheat. So everything in red is statistically different than the fallow, and everything in black is similar to fallow. But if you look at the cover crop, over that period, we always lost more money than fallow. But if we look at some of the forage situations, we quite often are making similar returns, and sometimes we're making more money. So we're in a fallow situation, we're losing about $55 an acre in chemical application costs. So if we lose less than $55 an acre, we're making money. So even though some of these are negative, we're still being more profitable than fallow. But if you look at just those years that we see a pretty negative hit on wheat yield, then the returns from growing a forage crop are no longer there. So in the real dry years, you're still better off to do fallow. So again, if we could predict this flex year system, we would be better off financially. But this is over a large number of years and gives us some indication that we can be more profitable when we grow a forage crop in there. The second experiment was to look at cover crops both before and after wheat. This study has been going on for 4 years now. And in the second year, we either grow grain sorghum or forage sorghum in place of fallow, and we have both minimum and no-till. And so we grow either a double crop cover crop after the wheat, or we're growing the cover crop in the fallow year. So looking at the grain sorghum, first of all, this is averaged over years. The capital GS is for grain sorghum, so that shows where the grain sorghum is in the rotation. So this is a winter wheat grain sorghum flex, fallow, oat, and then this is where we grow a double crop forage sorghum ahead of grain sorghum. So we didn't see any difference between these treatments and where we had the double crop cover crop ahead of grain sorghum. That's reducing our grain sorghum yield by about 50%. So a cover crop grown in that fallow period, which we had some producers asking about this fallow period, we're also seeing a negative response on the grain sorghum. Looking at forage sorghum, though, we see quite a bit different result. So again, capital FS is the forage sorghum, so that's the where we're interested in the rotation. where all these forage sorghum crops grown after wheat, the second year we don't see any difference. This treatment is a double crop forage sorghum, and this is a double crop forage sorghum in a couple of different rotations. And then this is the second year forage sorghum crop after the double crop forage sorghum. So in the grain sorghum, where we had the double crop, we saw a reduction in about 50% in yield. But with forage sorghum, we're not seeing a reduction in yield compared to full season and fallow after wheat. And then after the and then where we have the double crop, we're getting about a half a crop in there. So in this system here, these two combined, we're actually getting about 1.5 crops compared to one of these other rotations. So there is the potential to increase the cropping intensity more so with forages than there is strictly with grain sorghum. So if there's an opportunity there, if we're trying to eliminate fallow from the system, it seems like forages of that rotation is going to be key. The third experiment is really similar to experiment one. We used the research at Garden City and then identified those treatments that had kind of the most promise, and that's where we're integrating the grazing. And so we have these treatments, and then we have both minimum till and no-till in the graze treatments. So we have fallow, we have the flex treatment of oat and triticale, the oat triticale, a three-way mix, spring oat, spring triticale in a cocktail, and then a spring peas for grain. The cocktail is a six-species mixture of oat, triticale, pea, buckwheat, turnip, and radish. Looking at the forage dry matter yield and nutritive value, first of all, triticale has tended to produce the most yield. In our area, triticale comes on a little bit quicker, and it tends to out-yield oats in most years, but if the rain comes a little bit later in the spring, on occasion, once every 5 years, we might see the yield of oats be more. So that's why we kind of went to the two-way mix. It seems like it's more resilient over years. Looking at crude protein, we have very, very good crude protein. Where we have the legume in the mix, we have an increase in the crude protein, and then also in energy. We're seeing a little more higher digestibility of that legume, and getting a little more energy out of that three-way mix, or including that legume. So the grazing has occurred for a couple of years now. We're into our third year. So these are the periods we've grazed in the past, and so this is would be more considered more mob grazing. We also have some on-farm experiments, which are grazed over a longer period of time, but in the recently small plots, it's a fairly short grazing window. One of the concerns we had is potential compaction from grazing, and so if you look at some of the work that Lewis had done near Bushland, over time they've seen an increase in near surface compaction from grazing, and that resulted in a decline in yields over time. In the no-till system, and then also, but if you look at the data out in Nebraska, a different result there. They've actually seen an increase in crop yields over time through grazing. So this is something that we were wanting to investigate. You can see 2015, time the cattle were out there, we got rain, and there's a lot of this mudding up of this field from grazing. And then maybe the more what you would hope to have, 2016 is a drier conditions, and so. This was it was nice to see this these different conditions early on. So looking at soil bulk density in the surface from 2015 and 2016, 2015 the two graze treatments we saw an increase in bulk density, but in 2016 we really don't see any difference in treatments. So I think what we're seeing here is we're getting that increase in bulk density when we graze and the soil happens to be under wet conditions. So you want to, avoid grazing when fields are wet, but that's obviously a lot easier said than done. Where are you going to put those cattle? And especially if the whole window of the grazing season is wet, so it creates an issue. Looking at wheat yields, again, kind of similar results that we've been seeing before, that just environment, whether the precipitation has a big impact on the outcome of the results. But one of the things that we've been seeing so far in this study is really no difference in wheat yield, whether it's grazed, hayed, or cover. We're continuing to see similar yields. So that gives us indication and and hope that we can hay or graze these types of systems. Looking at now, that was averaged over the different subplots. Now looking at the breaking that down of minimum till and no-till. So the blue is no-till and the red is the reduced till, which is a one-time tillage operation with shallow sweeps in the fallow period after grazing. In 2016, you can see that the two graze treatments, the one-time tillage tended to see an increase in yield from the tillage, and then in 2017, actually, it was the opposite. We tended to see a slight reduction from the one-time tillage operation. Again, I think that where we had that muddy soil and that compaction going on, that one-time tillage alleviated that problem, and we were able to see an increase in yield. So we're hoping, we're going to look at this over a lot more years, but we're hoping it where in the study near Bushland where they saw a decrease over time from grazing, we're hoping that we can mitigate that with the one-time tillage operation. In conclusion, so replacing fallow with cover crops was never profitable, but forages were quite often profitable. But and I showed some of those treatments were not profitable. So in order for forages to be profitable, seed cost has to be minimized. So a seed treatment like a mixture that has very high seed costs, such as vetch, has very high seed cost. The seed cost of that makes it uneconomical. The other thing is that drives economics is forage yield. So the triticale and oats that produces twice to the yield as the legume only, that results in those treatments being profitable, where those legume only were not profitable. We did a sensitivity analysis, and we can withstand about a 7% yield reduction with the spring oat triticale type mix before that is no longer profitable. So that's how much cushion we have before that treatment starts to actually cost us more money. So we really need to look at the environment we're in and match that cropping intensity to what our environment is. And again, that 50, you know, and that where I think for our area, what the conditions is, that's about 50 bushels and less, where we really need to start using caution on increasing that intensity. And it's, you know, ultimately it's only sustainable if it is profitable. We have to keep that in mind. The actual implementation of this. So besides being an agronomist, my other hat I wear is a rancher. So we've implemented this personally on a large scale. And so you really have to plan for the what's unpredictable, you know, the weather. It's very easy to be too wet or too dry, and as a result, you have either too few ahead. You know, you can put 300 pair on an area and still be short cattle. So you have to that's a challenge. Obviously, you have to consider the logistics and cost of fencing and water. I think this is easiest implemented if it's could be nearby a rain situation where you can easily move cattle off of the field if it does get too wet. Likely you already have fencing in place, so that cost is nil, and then you have the watering facility on range. So that's where it's going to be very easily implemented. In some years that it's very dry, we're not going to be able to have enough moisture to both grow enough biomass for forage production plus provide good residue cover. So that's where it becomes very, very difficult. And I think Perry early on showed that difference between the livestock number and the forage number. So it in those years that you need that forage and it's too dry to grow anything, you're still in a world of hurt. So if you can put some of that in those good years, if you can bail that forage and have that as an insurance policy, that's going to help you get through those years. So I think that needs to be part of the overall plan. I want to acknowledge the funding partners for this work. And do we have any time for questions? No.